Welcome back to the program. As my guest, Jack Goldsmith, states at the outset of his new book, Power and Constraint, war and emergency, he says, invariably shift power to the presidency. Permanent war and permanent emergency threaten to make that shift permanent. Many believe that 9/11 and the actions of the Bush administration, continued by the Obama administration, make the idea of presidential accountability today almost impossible. But in Power and Constraint, the accountable presidency after 9/11, Harvard Law School professor Jack Goldsmith argues that post-9/11 American presidents are more accountable for their national security decisions than ever before. Jack Goldsmith is the Henry L. Shattuck Professor at the Harvard Law School. He's a member of the Hoover Institution Task Force on National Security, and he served in the Bush administration's Office of Legal Counsel. His previous memoir about that time was entitled The Terror Presidency, and it is my pleasure to welcome Jack Goldsmith here today to talk about his newest work, Power and Constraint, The Accountable Presidency After 9/11. Jack Goldsmith, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. One of the things that you argue as a central core here is that the Obama administration basically wound up in a very similar place with respect to many of these war powers and presidential issues as the Bush administration, but in many ways for entirely different reasons.
That's right. The Bush administration ended up where it did on issues by the end of its term, because it had been pushed there by courts and Congress and the press and human rights activists. It had been pushed to the right, so to speak, in favor of more rights for detainees, for example, against its will. But in the process of being pushed in that direction, courts, Congress, basically vetted what Bush was doing. It changed what he was doing, but then it blessed it and said it was lawful and legitimate. And that was the legacy that Obama inherited. And when he had the responsibilities of the presidency, he wasn't going to walk away from that legal support.
In many ways, though, Obama campaigned initially against many of these powers, against many of these ideas.
He did and he didn't. He did certainly leave the impression that everything was going to change in counterterrorism. As I go through in the book, he left himself lots of subtle wiggle room in his campaign positions. What he was really campaigning against was the early Bush administration positions on all these issues. And as Obama himself said soon after he got into office, things had changed a lot by the time he got there. So there's no doubt that he left the impression he was going to change things dramatically. But he didn't do that once he got in office.
Talk about the ways in which things morphed during the Bush administration, how it started out, where it ultimately got to in ways that the Obama administration was able to embrace.
Well, let's take one issue, just Gitmo. When Bush first brought detainees to Gitmo, he wouldn't allow them to go to federal court. He didn't give them very many legal rights. Over the course of 7 years, there was lots of litigation in the United States. The Supreme Court several times got involved in and pushed back against the commander-in-chief. Really, for the first time in American history, the courts really got involved and said no to the president in wartime. They extended rights to Gitmo, to the detainees there. The Congress got involved and extended rights to Gitmo. The same thing happened on military commissions. We had this really contentious 7 years about military commissions, Gitmo, detention, and the like. And by the time we got to January of 2009, it had basically all been worked out that as long as more rights were given and courts could review it and Congress got involved, it was okay. And those things had happened by the time Obama got in office. And he had task force that really vetted those issues, and he wanted to take a different course. But the truth is that when he got in office and had the responsibilities of the presidency and he saw how things had been worked out better than he thought, and he saw that he had all this legal support, he wasn't going to walk away from that. No president would.
To what extent was this actually the courts and Congress vetting these things as opposed to simply reacting to the extremists of the early Bush administration positions and actions?
Well, I would say those are the same thing. The Bush administration did stake out some aggressive positions early on after 9/11. I talked about that a lot in my earlier book. But it was precisely those policies that Congress, sometimes in some respects Congress approved them when it considered them, and in some respects the courts approved them when they considered them. But in other respects, they thought the Bush administration went too far. And that's not unusual. Presidents at the outsets of wars often stake out an aggressive posture when we don't understand the enemy, when we don't see how the war is going. What's unusual is the extent to which courts and Congress, and really helped by the press, which really disclosed things, deep secrets in ways it never has before, and this network of lawyers and auditors, both inside and outside the executive branch, who were watching and revealing what the president was doing, all of those forces caused Bush to go to a place where he definitely didn't want to go, and that's really kind of unprecedented in American wartime history.
Doesn't that create a kind of extra constitutional set of checks and balances that certainly seems to be working with respect to the policies that you're talking about, but to what extent can they be relied on as precedent for other presidents and other wars going forward?
Well, I don't think they're extra constitutional. I mean, it was, we really are talking mostly about, or primarily about, courts and Congress and the press. And those were the institutions that Madison and the framers thought would check the presidency, including the presidency in war. So I don't think it's extra constitutional, but I do think that it's new in the sense that the way these forces operated and the way that especially they got helped by NGOs and the press and some new institutions that Congress put inside the executive branch, like inspectors general, to watch what was going on in secret. I do think that those led to more robust checks than ever before in wartime. And I do think, and I'm quite confident actually, that those precedents and those institutions will apply in future wars, and certainly in this war, which is going to go on for a very, very long time.
I guess the question is the degree to which the Constitution really provides the basis to allow these systems to self-correct in the way that they have.
Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said that the Constitution worked well. He was the author of the Imperial Presidency. He said, I think correctly, that the Constitution, the main virtue of the Constitution was that it allowed for self-correction. That when you had other institutions of government watching the presidency, that we could figure out what we were doing right and wrong and fix it. And I think that's exactly what happened. I do think, so I talk about in the book about how the extent to which what's gone on in the last decade is like what the framers envisioned and the extent to which it's not like what they envisioned. In many respects, of course, the framers never could have imagined the super powerful presidency we have, the giant secrecy bureaucracy and endless war against Islamist terrorists. That would have been something they could not even have begun to understand. But the system that's worked out, even though it hasn't worked precisely the way they thought it would because the world was much simpler back then, it is a system of watching and checking the president and pushing him to a place where there's more consensus, legal and political. And one of the remarkable things about everything Obama's doing now, and that includes targeted killing, which is the most controversial thing he's doing, is the extent to which it enjoys the support of the American people and the support of courts and Congress. We really are at a moment, again, nothing is ever settled, but we really are at a moment of remarkable consensus, legal and political, in support of of the president's basic counterterrorism powers.
How much of that, though, still comes out of fear, even 10 years after 9/11?
Well, certainly a lot of it is fear, and both inside the executive branch and by the American people. But I don't think you can just attribute it to fear, because there was really a lot of pushback against Bush's policies at a time when the nation was more fearful. And, for example, there's much more support now for military commissions than there was 6 or 7 years ago. What's happened in the interim? Well, we've got Congress blessing it. We have courts saying that it's okay in theory if Congress blesses it. We have a second congressional statute that made the process even more rigorous. And we have a Democratic president who was a critic of military commissions who's looked at it hard and now says he thinks they're okay. So I don't think it's just attributable to fear. I don't think that's the right way to think about it.
And yet, as much as there is continuity in these policies, you had a situation a few years ago where you had former Vice President Cheney out there criticizing the actions of the Obama administration for weakening the country.
Right. And so the one thing that Obama did do that was different than Bush was he ended the interrogation and black site program of the CIA. And that's the main thing that Cheney was criticizing. Even that change by Obama, which Cheney criticized a great deal, the truth is that those policies were ending under the Bush administration. The last 2 years, the secret prisons were barely used, and the interrogation program, because of stuff done by Congress, had been changed and limited quite a lot. So the criticisms Cheney was making at the dawn of the Obama administration, where he was actually making inside the executive branch when the executive branch was pulling back under late Bush, But it's also true, I think, that the vice president very successfully early on when Obama was sorting all this stuff out, he was out there relentlessly criticizing him for jeopardizing national security. I think that it had an impact in forcing and sort of rallying people to be concerned about Obama's attempts to maybe back off of what Bush was doing. And I do think it had an impact in causing them to continue many of the Bush policies. Now, Cheney today is congratulating Obama these days because he has, in fact, continued so many of the late Bush policies.
Is there a danger on the other side that some of these new, this new normal of checks and balances will create undue constraints on the presidency?
There certainly is, and I talk about that as well in the book. You know, all of these people, all the lawyers watching what's going on inside the presidency, all the judicial decisions, it really makes, it slows down the executive, it makes it harder for him to act. It sometimes chills officials from acting. That's the bad side of all this scrutiny. And so there's a constant balance and a constant recalibration going on between wanting to make sure that the presidency and this secretive, indefinite war, global war, to make sure that he's following the law and not making mistakes. And on the other hand, you have to worry that too much watching will lead the president to be cautious. Now, 9/11, many people think the 9/11 Commission said that one of the problems that led us to be to have our guard down on 9/11 was lawyer-induced risk aversion in the 1990s in the CIA and other places. And there's a constant danger that, and many people think, that we're back in that same position again because we've developed such an extreme accountability system.
When you have generals like General Petraeus going around and not wanting to be anywhere without a lawyer present, it's somewhat worrisome in that regard.
Well, I don't know if it's worrisome. I mean, I have a chapter in which I interview General Petraeus, and I have a chapter about how law has been incorporated into the military. Petraeus sees law and lawyers and law compliance as absolutely vital to the exercise of power. Because look at what happened in Afghanistan the other day. That wasn't that was when one soldier does something sort of illegal or off the reservation like that, it can have an enormous effect on the entire U.S. military effort. And so it's very important, and it's very important to the mission for Petraeus to make sure that his soldiers act lawfully and consistent with the laws of war. He doesn't see it as a constraint. He sees it as empowering because it enables him to do things they wouldn't otherwise be able to do, and also because it keeps them from doing things they shouldn't do that can hurt them.
What are the new responsibilities or the responsibilities of Congress under this new paradigm?
Well, Congress is probably the most feckless branch of the government. They are the ones that, in my opinion and the opinion of many people, don't exercise their responsibilities fully or regularly. And the truth is Congress has done a lot in the last decade, but they've done so reactively after other institutions have put an issue on their plate, like interrogation or military commissions or something like that. Congress has an ongoing role, in especially in the intelligence and military world, of supervising what the executive branch is doing, especially in secret. I think that those committees are doing a much better job than ever of taking their job seriously and really scrutinizing and holding the executive's feet to the fire. There have been a lot of stories lately about how well that process is working. Also, Congress did something very important at the end of 2011. It basically reauthorized the war on terrorism and it updated the war on terrorism that it basically authorized in 2001. And that was very controversial, and so they did some things that Barack Obama didn't like. The checks and balances that pushed back against Bush are also pushing back against Obama. Congress has prevented Obama from closing Gitmo, prevented Obama from having civilian trials of Gitmo detainees. So they've been remarkably active. They could be more active. I still think they're probably the weakest institution in this whole scheme.
And certainly one of the key institutions in this has been the press and what they have been able to report at various times.
No doubt about it. The first chapter I have explaining how this system of accountability works is called Accountability Journalism. And to my mind, I quote the foreign affairs editor of the Washington Post saying that when Dick Cheney said in 2001 that this war was going to be fought in the shadows, and that this war was going to go on for a long time, we realized that if that's where the war was going to be fought, we had to go there. And the press has done that, and they have reported on and disclosed more about secret and covert action of the government. It's hard to measure, but in my opinion, in this war than in any prior war. And that's been at the basis of a lot of the change and alteration of the policies and ultimately the legitimation of the policies. Now that too, like your earlier point, when the press discloses national security secrets, sometimes that is very harmful to national security. And I talk about that, and I talk about the negative consequences of that. But it does have an accountability effect. It did lead the government to change and improve its policies in many respects. Whatever you think of the virtues and vices of it, there's no doubt that the disclosures by the press of what's going on inside the government have led to a lot of the scrutiny that's led to a lot of the change and legitimation of the counterterrorism policies.
In members and leaders of the press that you interviewed for the book, what do you think was the primary impetus for this new energy, really, as far as the press goes? Certainly it is a far different press than we saw in the run-up to the Iraq War.
Well, that was one of the things that caused them to... Well, first of all, let me say, they were at this from the beginning. They were in the shadows trying to report on this stuff. I go back and show how, in fact, the press was telling us about the secret prisons and the aggressive interrogation program of the CIA. They were actually reporting on that in 2002, right after the program began, and really no one was paying attention then. I mean, it was on the front page of the Washington Post and the New York Times. At that time, the nation, not the details, but some of the details, not all the details, at that time, the nation just wasn't as concerned about that. But you're right that the Iraq War and the perception and reality that the press blew it in covering the WMD rationale for the Iraq War really, really made them redouble their efforts in getting at the truth of what's going on inside the government. So I think that there's a natural inclination, obviously, to cover war and national security. It was hard to do at first because things were super secretive in the first year or two. Even during that super secret period, they were reporting on things that were classified and covert. But it was really the Iraq War and the failures there that led them to be more aggressive, I think.
How important have whistleblowers been and the equivalent people inside various agencies and organizations?
Whistleblowers have been a little bit consequential, but to my mind, much more consequential and much more important is a very boring institution called the Inspector General. And that is basically a watchdog inside each executive branch agency that essentially works for Congress. And especially in the CIA and the Department of Justice, the Inspectors General after 9/11 were just ruthless in figuring out what was going on, stopping what they thought were abusive practices, rationalizing the practices, getting information so that Congress could scrutinize it. One example is that the practice of waterboarding was the CIA interrogation program was scrutinized inside the government by the Inspector General, and changes were brought to it long before anything broke to the public. Waterboarding we've been debating it for 8 years now, but it hasn't been practiced since 2003, and one of the reasons it was stopped was because of this internal watchdog. It was more complicated than that, as I talk about in the book, mm-hmm. But these internal watchdogs are hugely important in bringing accountability to the presidency, especially when it acts in secret.
How important have the courts been?
Well, again, they've been super important. If of all of the innovations in the last decade that are surprising and consequential, I think that bringing judicial review to basically to the president's basic wartime decisions about who can be targeted, who can be killed, having to justify detentions from the battlefield, giving enemy soldiers full-blown habeas corpus rights, these are all brand new things in American history. We've become so used to courts being involved after 9/11 that we've, I think, forgotten how novel it is. And in many ways, along with the press, the most important institution have been the courts, because they were the ones that said the president can't act in this way, for example, about military commissions unless Congress approves. That in turn forced Bush to go to Congress. That in turn forced Congress to exercise its responsibilities. So I would say that, especially against the background of before 9/11, courts didn't get involved in wars at all, basically, during the war, in pushing back against the president. So they, too, have been very important in ways that I think are underappreciated.
What about this point that, and this was with respect to the targeted killings, the point that Attorney General Holder made the other day, talking about this difference, this distinction between due process and judicial process?
Right. He made a point, and he was beaten up for it, but I think he was right, essentially. He said that due process, which the Constitution guarantees that no person's life, liberty, or property shall be taken without due process. And most people think that due process means judicial process, but that's not what the Constitution says, and that's not what it's meant. In wartime, and the Supreme Court has made clear that what process is due depends on context. And the Court has also made clear in several cases in World War II and after 9/11 that American citizens are subject to the full range of presidential powers in war, and that their citizenship, as long as the president complies with the laws of war, that their citizenship doesn't make a difference. What Holder was talking about was that before the decision for targeted killing was made, there was lots of process given to that decision, both within the executive branch and between the executive branch and Congress. And in his view, and in my view, that's the appropriate process that was due. I should also add, though, that here again, courts have been involved. The ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights sued the Obama administration about its targeted killing powers. The courts looked at it, and the court determined that it was an issue not for courts, that the Constitution did not give that issue for courts to review. It gave it to the political branches. And so, once again, even though the courts didn't get involved, they looked at it, and they decided that the Constitution required them not to get involved.
And finally, talk about the ways in which this is all tied up with this notion of almost permanent war and how we need to look at this in that context.
Right. So the system I've been describing to you is really, almost everything I described is new or more extreme than in prior wars. And a lot of people think it's too much, and we talked a bit about how there are costs to this system. But we are in an age where the Constitution essentially assumes that war will not be a permanent state of affairs, that war is exceptional, and that during that exceptional time, the president has to have more extreme powers. After 9/11, we're in a situation where war is basically going to go on in some form or another for a very long time, certainly indefinitely. And so we need to have some sort of compensating accountability for when the president's powers are enhanced permanently. The system I've described, when courts are more involved, the press is more involved, these internal watchdogs are more involved, there's a lot more legal scrutiny, a lot more lawsuits, a lot more, many more hurdles to jump over before the president can act. These are, in effect, constitutional responses to this novelty that the president is going to be the commander-in-chief on an indefinite basis.
Jack Goldsmith, the book is Power and Constraint, The Accountable Presidency After 9/11. It's just out from W.W. Norton. Jack, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much.